Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Behavior Health Integration episode. Today, I have a very special guest, Chloe Carmichael. Chloe is a licensed clinical psychologist and author. Dr. Chloe specializes in relationship issues, stress management, and career coaching. She has appeared as an expert on ABC, CBS, VH1, and other national media. Dr. Chloe has a new book that's out called Nervous Energy: Harness the Power of Your Anxiety. In today's episode, we will get into discussions on how to start a successful private practice, stress, depression, anxiety, relationship issues, and again, how to apply coping skills and techniques to manage your anxiety, and so much more. And I am truly excited to get this episode started. So without further ado, let's begin.
Hi, Jacob. Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
You're welcome. How are you doing today?
Very well. How about yourself?
Good, good. I forgot to ask you, where are you calling from right now?
Oh, I'm in Florida.
Oh, nice. Nice. What part?
I'm in Orlando. My practice is based in New York, but I came to Florida because as a psychologist, I was very concerned about masking my then 3-year-old back in 2020.
Okay. No, it's nice. My parents are actually building a place on the Keys.
Cool.
Right now. Duck Key, to be exact.
Nice. I don't know the Keys very well. I'm still kind of a newbie here, but I've heard the Keys are awesome.
Yeah, minus the hurricanes.
Yeah, there's that. Where are you?
Minnesota.
Okay, cool.
Yep, good old Midwest. It's actually snowing pretty good right now. I think we might get like 6 or 7 inches tonight.
Yeah, I grew up in Michigan myself. Sometimes I check the weather there just to, I don't do well with cold. So I really enjoy the warm weather.
So did you grow up in Michigan and then move to Florida and stay there? Or did you move a lot?
No. So I grew up in Michigan. And when I was 8 years old, I told everybody I was going to live in New York and be on television.
Oh, nice.
And then in August of 2001, I did indeed move to New York, Manhattan, and accomplished my goals and stayed there quite happily, you know, until 2020.
Okay. No, the reason I asked that is because of the weather concept where people just, I don't know, like when they come to Minnesota the first time, there's a lot of Minnesota people that will just try to be nice and be like, oh, you'll get used to it. Then you'll get like the other half like, no, you won't. It's going to be very cold and at times miserable. And that's just the way it is.
I think that the key for the cold is to at least get away, you know, like I've actually saved a lot of money now because I don't have to spend money on tropical vacations every winter, yep. Which is nice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Obviously, we'll talk about your Nervous Energy book. I love your 10 dating commandments. You don't want to call them commandments anymore. They're guidelines or?
Oh, well, the title of the book is Dr. Chloe's 10 Commandments of Dating. So that's fine to refer to the book, of course, by its title. And then in the book, I explain that the word commandments is kind of tongue in cheek. It's just, you know, a play on words, but that it's all guidelines. People have to do what they need to do, et cetera.
Maybe intertwine that with anxiety and dating anxiety nowadays and how it may be different compared to like the past.
Oh my goodness. Yes. I mean, I've actually even looked at potentially writing a book that is like Nervous Energy for Dating, kind of combining those things.
That's very good. That's very good. Have you ever heard of the gentleman Andrew Tate?
Of course.
But again, I don't know about you, but like, I've heard about him maybe 6 to 8 months ago. But he's a huge name right now. Wouldn't you agree?
Totally.
I here's the funny thing. As a therapist, I actually agree with some of the things that he said. It's just the way he just comes off is just horrendous sometimes. And he does that on purpose to, again, gain more views. But what are your concepts on him? And do you think he's hurting the relationship field and whatnot?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, so I'll say, first of all, I'm not extremely familiar with him. So whatever I may say about him should be taken, you know, with a big grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you that I think that sometimes he intentionally words things. I think I've even actually heard him acknowledge this, that he enjoys, you know, kind of getting a rise out of people, and that he'll deliberately word things in ways that are going to be provocative. However, like you said, I think a lot of, you know, just the ideas underneath a lot of what he's saying actually hold a fair amount of common sense. As for whether he's, you know, quote, damaging to, you know, the dating scape or the relationship scape, I think you could probably find things in Cosmopolitan magazine that are harmful or damaging to, you know, the dating scape or to the relationship scape. So the answer is yes. I'm sure in some ways, you know, he is harmful if, you know, he's just saying things that are supercharged and making people irritated. That's not really a bridge building thing to do. On the other hand, sometimes I think when we are hearing such a monolithic rhetoric from the media about toxic masculinity.
There it is.
And, you know, that, you know, women, you know, should sleep with hundreds of people and it will be totally fine for the woman. And we're just hearing this, like, you know, monolithic chorus. I can understand just the frustration and the temptation to just say, wait a minute, I want to kind of throw a wrench in this stupid machine and say something that will be a little bit provocative, but that will at least like make everybody just stop and think. I'm not saying I think he's doing it in the right way, mm-hmm. but I think I kind of understand some of the frustration.
Well, just, yeah, like that, the classic double standard, and men can sleep with whoever they want to, and then they're looked at as a god, as a king. But if a woman does it, she's a slut, as society portrays.
Right. I'm not even honestly entirely sure that's true anymore. I mean, I think slut shaming has become a worse word than slut.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not into, I think the narrative that you're describing might have been accurate 20 years ago, but I don't think anymore.
Maybe longer than that, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you ever heard of these, and I don't want to waste too much of your time too, but I just find these conversations very fascinating, to be honest with you.
We can talk about whatever you want.
Oh God, no. Just, have you ever heard of the red pill, blue pill thing?
I know the red pill, but I'm not sure what the blue pill is.
So, and I might not even know what the red pill is, because I keep going on YouTube videos. I'm like, I'm a simple guy. It's just like, tell me what red pill is, and no one can really give me an example, but they just like go off of stories of they're aggressive, confident, masculine. They don't take shit from women. And I'm like, okay, well, is like that the definition, or are those just traits of a red pill man? And a blue pill, I guess, from what they're trying to say, is they're more passive. They maybe go with gender norms. They let the woman walk over them. They try to do things to attract a woman that is usually normally a turnoff. Let's say, again, I love conversations like this where the classic example, I'm going to get this woman to like me and I'm going to do nice things for her. I'm going to pay her rent. I'm going to do this and that. Well, just the rent paying thing is just major kind of boundary issues. And you doing things like that is actually, or could be turning them off in a sense.
Right. Like the whole simping thing.
Yes. Simping. Yes. A simp.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of a new definition too, right?
I guess. I mean, I've sort of heard it for a few years, but I mean, I guess maybe being in New York, like lingo happens a little faster.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Like two or three years. And it just means like, I don't know, like you're a dork, you're a loser. You bend over backwards for a woman and she's never going to show you any interest. And
just a doormat. I think it's just a modern word for a doormat.
Yeah. I like listening to a lot of reaction videos too. I don't know if you ever heard of the Psychology in Seattle guy, Kirk Honda. Yeah, he does reaction videos with this one show, Blind, Love is Blind. Have you ever heard of that?
I may have heard of it. Is it where people get married that don't know each other?
but they're talking through like a door.
Okay.
So they can't see each other, but they're talking to develop a relationship, and they have to decide if they're going to marry that person or not.
Wow.
And there's a scene where this one woman was talking to two guys, and they're both interested in her at one point, but she's more interested. I forgot the guy's name. Anyways, let's say she's more interested in guy B, but guy A is falling for her. And when her and guy A were having a session, she's like, yeah, I just don't know about this and that. And he's like, well, what the heck, whatever. So then she leaves guy A and then she pursues guy B, but then guy B is not really interested in her anymore. So what does she do to try to maintain to be on the show? She got back together with guy A, and the guy A took her back.
Mm-hmm.
That for, I don't know, like a lot of times they would use that as an example of simping, where it's just like, dude, she's not interested in you. She rejected you. Yet you're still taking her back only because the guys that she wanted wasn't into her anymore.
Yeah. I mean, as a psychologist, what comes to mind, of course, is the term repetition compulsion, right? The thing where we feel like we just have to keep repeating something because maybe we'll get it right this time. So for guy A, it probably felt really bad when she walked out on him. And, maybe on some level, having her come back to him, he was allowed to then tell himself a story that, if he felt, say, feelings of worthlessness when she left, then if he can redo the moment with her and this time it works out where she wants to stay with him, then he gets to lose those feelings of rejection.
Yes.
Of course, the problem is, as you're pointing out, that he's failing to really look at the whole picture and understand that she's not really coming to him because she wants to be with him. She's coming to him because he's temporarily useful to her.
Yes.
The issue, though, of course, is it's not only men who are simps, I can tell you. It is so sad.
But that's all you hear about is men. I'd never heard of a woman simp.
You know what? I think women just keep it secret, okay? Because... books like The Rules for Women, or books like He's Just Not That Into You. Those are books for women who have problems with boundaries with men, where they overcommit. They're too easy. They get wrapped up and desperate on somebody before he is committed to them. I think women might just be a little bit less public about it because a man can kind of wrap the simping behaviors by masculine bravado, like, whatever, I just went back and got her, whereas for the women, it's like, well, if you're chasing somebody or you appear desperate, it's a little bit of a different type of a social status. So I think women may be more undercover simpers sometimes.
But they
do simp.
Well, and I think that can go to men as well, but they maybe use a different term for it.
Yeah.
But I like the term undercover. It's like you're kind of like putting a mask on and you're hiding from your simp itch, if you want to say.
Yeah.
Okay. Just Chloe, right off the bat, what originally got you into the mental health field in the first place?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was very, very young, my parents had a couple over to our house, and the woman was a psychologist. And when I say young, I mean like maybe age 9. And I learned about her job as a psychologist. And basically, in my 9-year-old brain, what I took away from it is you sit in a comfortable room and people come in and they tell you all their secrets, and then they pay you and then they leave. And I was like, okay, as a little girl, like, getting to know people's secrets is whatever. It's just, especially for me, but I think stereotypically we want to know everybody's secrets. And so I would go to these great lengths to befriend people and get them to tell me their secrets, et cetera. And I'm like, wait a minute, you mean the people just come, they tell you their secrets, and then they pay you and then they leave? I'm like, oh, it sounded like heaven. And I think, I kind of forgot about it. It's not like the idea stayed with me that long, but that was my first exposure to it. And then I actually benefited a lot from seeing a therapist myself in my life. And so that was, another reason I think that just attracted me to it. But what actually just logistically led to it, I was a yoga teacher living in New York, teaching individual yoga lessons, making individual yoga programs for people where the physical postures would work in tandem with meditations and mental exercises, seeing really exciting changes happening for people. And I started to feel like I wanted to learn more about the mind side. I was also aware that there was probably a shelf life on me as a yoga teacher that was going to, you know, get paid a lot of money. I thought, you know, when I'm like 50, do I really want to be walking around apartment to apartment, like offering people yoga lessons?
Yep.
And so it just kind of reinvigorated my thoughts about what do I really want to do? I had not even finished college at that point. And so I then went back and I finished college, thankfully, at Columbia University, got a 4.0 and was able to get then directly into a clinical psychology PhD program at a very competitive program. And just once I knew what I wanted to do, it happened kind of like a laser beam.
Excellent. And then did you get into private practice right away? Or did you work at, let's say, a community mental health clinic? How'd that go about?
Yeah. So during my training, so as you know, your listeners probably know that to get a clinical PhD, there's years and years of just clinical training that is required. You just can't speed up certain things. You have to clock, you know, thousands of hours of training under supervised, you know, psychologists, which is great. It was a labor of love. It was a major gift to me. And so during that time, yes, I worked at some mental health clinics. But I always knew I wanted to do private practice, and I didn't have a financial safety net like at all. And so I was very keenly aware that I needed to be in a situation where I could pay my bills. I almost said get my bills paid. I mean, like where I needed to be the one to pay those bills. And so I knew I wanted to do private practice, and that I needed to be in private practice with people who could afford to pay. And interestingly, I also knew I was really interested in working with people that were willing and able and eager to take my interventions and do something with them. Now, it's not 100% correlation. Obviously, some people are financially successful or, you know, wealthy and they've never worked a day in their life. Some people are very hardworking, but they're stuck in poverty. But there's a general connection that hard work and conscientiousness tends to lead to financial stability. So it was actually kind of a perfect mix for me, that wanting to do private practice with organized, driven people also tended to be the people that were going to be able to help me with my goal of being able to pay off those freaking student loans and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, that gives me anxiety just thinking about that, because I have six figures in student loans right now, so I can relate.
Yeah.
So is that also where you kind of got your motivation to like help other practitioners develop their private practice?
You know what? Okay, so to be totally honest, where that came from, I started my private practice not even knowing if I was going to be able to fill up my one single chair. You know, I just had no idea. Like, they don't teach you anything about having a private practice when you're learning all your great therapy skills. I didn't know if I was going to be successful. To my great surprise, I was successful beyond my wildest dreams. And within like literally a couple of months, I had to start hiring other therapists to keep up with the demand. And what then started happening is tons of therapists. It felt like everywhere I would go, like whether I would be like in person or just on LinkedIn approaching me all the time, that, hey, how do you get clients? How do you get clients? You know, just constantly asking me this. And I have to admit, I went through a bit of a process, because I think early on I was a little sensitive. And I was like, well, because I'm a good therapist, like I was almost resentful. Yeah. Like, what do you mean? How do I get clients? Like, I'm a good therapist, you know? But then I evolved and I was like, okay, wait a minute. Some of these people are also very, very good therapists.
Well, can I tell you something? Like the common theme of that is whenever a therapist like stops becoming a therapist and they do like a regular job, like serving or business, and their coworkers, whatever, find out they're a therapist, they're like, oh, you must have sucked. I mean, what are you doing here? That's the
misconception. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I also learned it by hiring therapists. I would hire excellent therapists that would be, you know, I could put clients in front of them and they'd book those clients and they were great therapists, but I knew that they were working for me because they maybe didn't know how to get their own clients. Some of them, they know how to get them. They just don't want to be bothered with business. But I discovered I just had a lot of people constantly asking me how do they get clients? And part of my, you know, business acumen is an awareness that time is money. And so I didn't want, to be honest, to just keep repeating the same answers for free to people, wasting time that I could have been spending on my own business. And I also, I get sick of saying things. So that's why Dr. Chloe's 10 Commandments of Dating, my book, the Nervous Energy book, other stuff. I get into stuff. I'm excited to talk about it. And then it's like, okay, I don't want to just repeat it again for the 100th time. So that's what inspired me to just say, why don't I just make a video series about how to get clients, everything that I do to get clients, to keep clients, et cetera. I'll just put it on video and then I'll sell it. So that way, if people really want to know, they can just download it. And then I don't have to feel like I'm stuck in the middle between wanting to help people, but also having my own needs of my own, you know, need to get compensated for my time. And to be honest, like, I knew at a certain point, my enthusiasm for saying these things was going to die. So I was like, I better just put it on film and sell it.
No, it really makes a lot of sense too. And now, there's three also principles that you follow by, right? It's sustainability, organization, and profitability, right?
For a practice, for a private practice, yes.
So sustainability as in you make enough money to, again, prolong your career in that field. Is that the basic definition of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. But yes, I mean, your practice has to be sustainable in the sense that, like, it has to be financially solvent. It has to be sustainable for you as a person. So if you're charging so little that you end up having to see way too many clients and you're going to get totally burnt out, it's not sustainable. There's also the issue of sustainability in terms of wanting to make sure that you're giving back to your community and, you know, being a good citizen within your community. I, you know, being able to do, you know, pro bono services, financial donations and charity, those kinds of things. I put all those things under sustainability.
Well, and I think another thing you need to consider, which is going on right now, and it's pretty sad, is the shame that other therapists will put on each other when it comes to charging rates, which is absolutely ridiculous. But let's say I want to charge $200-$300. Another therapist could be like, oh, you're a monster. You should be trying to help people, this and that. It's like, I'm doing what I'm doing to be successful and my clients are fine. Worry about you. Why? What is it about you that is so concerned about me hypothetically charging $300 as an example for a client?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very strange one because, you know, I don't understand where such people would assume that you are not, you know, potentially also offering pro bono or discounted sessions, or even just simply choosing to financially donate your money in other ways, right? Like, we all have different ways of charging and, you know, managing our money. Moreover, I actually talk about this in some of my videos, which people can even just get some of them for free. So if you do go, you can put it in the links and everything. But if people go to profitablepractices.net, they can even just sign up and get some, you know, free videos where I talk about some of this stuff too. But if a therapist has money issues and is uncomfortable charging, you know, market rate or even more than market rate, if you are better than the average therapist on the market, I think it's harder for you to then really lead and guide clients when you're having those conversations with clients about saying, you know what, maybe you should advocate for a raise for yourself at work. Or, you know, do you really feel like, you know, you're on the right path of professional development? Are you getting enough vacation time? Are you getting enough benefits at work? When we can model good professional financial boundaries through our own actual practice, I believe it actually can be helpful to clients personally.
Yeah. And I listen to a lot of like podcasts too about, you know, having the awkward conversation too. Let's say if you are going to raise your rates, How do you approach your client with that? Hey, I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to raise my rates a little bit. How are you with that?
Yeah. So again, people can DM me as well if they want. I'm all over social media, and I actually have a whole blog specifically about how to raise fees for therapists. And so there's a lot of different ways to do it, Jacob. And I've done a lot of different ways myself over time, because every practice and situation is different, right? But one way that a lot of therapists kind of respond well to is to just simply have it in your client agreement that your rates are going to raise by X percent on March 1st of every year, with like a little clause that says, you know, if you're joining my practice in January or February, then you're exempt from the March raise. You know, I'll honor, you know, your fee for at least a certain amount of time or whatever. But when it's just, and then, you know, the client has to initial that part maybe when they fill out the paperwork. So it's not a surprise to anybody. So one way to do it is to have an automatic. Another way to do it is to just raise the fees on new clients, right? So you can even tell your existing clients, I'm raising my fees. I just want you to know that in case, you know, you should be thinking of referring any of your friends to my practice or whatever. I just want you to know my new fee is actually such and such, but I'm going to grandfather you in at this old fee for a period of 6 months or, you know, whatever it is that makes sense to you.
No, those are all really good points. They really are. Now I want to get into like a different direction. As we all know, you have a specialty in anxiety. Did you always have that, or did you develop that along your career?
Well, I would say I developed it along the way in my career. And I actually got it through a very interesting, it was through a conversation with my dermatologist of all people, you know, back when I was still in graduate school. And, you know, because actually dermatologists tend to refer a fair amount of clients to therapists, right? Because especially like cosmetic types of dermatologists, which is what I was seeing, because, you know, maybe we tend to be, you know, kind of issues with perfectionism or issues with self-esteem or, you know, whatever. And so anyway, I was talking about it with him about what I was, you know, interested in specializing in. And he said, you know, I just want you to think about something in terms of business. He said, if you think about it, people with depression might, one of their symptoms, you know, is lethargy, a lack of engagement, et cetera. You know, whereas people with anxiety, it's very, very high levels of conscientiousness, almost a sense of overdrive, you know, like as far as, you know, remembering their appointment on, you know, being goal driven and goal oriented. And he said, I think number one, in terms of your personality, you'd probably fit better with that set. And he said, and from a business perspective, because he knew that that was important to me too, he said that might actually be smoother for you. And that was very interesting. And I just kind of made a mental note of that. And then I began to notice that with my practice, the types of clients that were coming to see me tended to be the ones that were dealing with anxiety. Now, obviously, it's not a 100% correlation. There's many extremely driven, successful people that struggle with depression. And there are many people with anxiety that, you know, are not productive, and their anxiety becomes a barrier, you know, to even the most basic of goal attainments. So I'm not talking about absolutes here, but these were just general trends. And so I started then to notice that the people with anxiety were also, just in my, you know, experience, more likely to be thankful when I would give them homework to try. They were grateful. They would go do it. They would come back. They would want to report on it. Whereas a lot of times, again, with depression, the barriers were more like just irritability, which is, again, another symptom of depression. I to be plainly honest, just didn't want to spend my days necessarily sitting one-to-one with people that were just going to be irritable with me and then not do the work I was asking them to do and then complain that they weren't getting results. I just knew that I personally probably didn't even have the right attitude to truly help and meet those people where they were at.
Now, what does your homework normally entail? Just educating your clients on particular like coping skills and making them become more aware of, like, hey, when they normally get triggered to, again, apply those coping skills.
Mm-hmm. So I'm on sabbatical from offering psychotherapy right now. I'm doing some coaching. Working with some corporate clients, and, you know, obviously I'm doing a lot of speaking, writing with my books and things like that. But when I am working with clients, I would say what the work typically includes is learning what brings you here. You know, people don't typically come to me just because they need an open space to talk about themselves. You know, that there's a fine place and time for that, but you don't need to pay what I charge in order to do that. I employ other therapists, and sometimes I'll connect people with those therapists if that's just really all that's needed, is just a supportive listening environment. But a lot of times when people are coming to me, they want to tell me about some obstacle that they're having. They can't get to the next level in their job. They can't seem to tie down a relationship, you know, whatever it is, there's some kind of a obstacle. And so I look with them at, what is this obstacle? What are the psychology hacks that I might know that can help that person? How can we apply those hacks in terms of, you know, specific homework that's going to help them build and practice skills that will help them to overcome their obstacle?
So those hacks can be considered like irrational thinking, false beliefs, et cetera?
Absolutely. So in my book, there are 9 techniques. It's not 100% that every session I have is only those techniques, but I did write this book, again, to my earlier point of that I don't like to repeat myself too much. So I just, when I was asked to write a book and I said, okay, well, what should I write about? They said, okay, well, what are the things that you're always telling clients? I said, okay, so let me think about that. And I wrote down like the kind of like 9 techniques and things that I tend to use a lot. And so anyway, yeah, I might say, look at irrational thinking, right? For example, if somebody has an irrational thinking problem, I might say, well, okay, is this one that's going to be best solved by thought replacement? Or is this one that's going to be solved, you know, by opposite action? Or I would then look at what techniques would help them to get past whatever the maladaptive pattern is.
Excellent, excellent. And then when we get into like dating, or I'm sure that's where a lot of clients could have issues and they go to their therapist because of relationship issues. And is that more kind of what inspired you to do the 10 commandments of dating?
Yeah. So the 10 commandments of dating, I wrote, Dr. Chloe's 10 commandments of dating, I wrote years ago. And that one I actually wrote because I was asked by a wonderful man named Ernie Anastos. He's I think a 20-time Emmy award-winning news anchor in New York. And he had asked me to be on a segment for the news about dating season in New York. And one of my worst fears when I'm on TV is to be unprepared and run out of productive material to say, to just be sitting there with a big camera in my face and be like, I don't know. So I always overprepare. And so I came up with my top 10 tips, you know, for how to be successful in dating. And in the pregame of the show, I was going over my talking points with Ernie, knowing I would never have time for all 10, but that was kind of the idea. And he was like, Chloe, these are so good. You should put these into a book. And I said, you know what? You're right. You should. And so the first book was self-published. And then this book behind me was published by Macmillan. And it's now also been published in simplified Chinese, as well as Russian and Turkish and all kinds of other languages. But Dr. Chloe's 10 Commandments of Dating is just a little old self-published by me.
No, I got a funny story. When I was doing my residency for my counseling grad program, my first practice session, it was like the first, second day, and we were all like getting in front of the class and doing like practice therapy in front of the teacher. So I was just like asking the client, or which was the teacher, a bunch of questions about like the hypothetical client, this, that, this, that, this, that. And at the end of it, he's like, you know, I'm going to call you Popcorn from now on, because you just like threw out so many questions. Now, they were good questions. That's why I'm calling you Popcorn. But you got to think of therapy, especially the first session, like a date, where instead of asking like 50 questions, listen like appropriately and practice advanced listening skills. And then think of like three or four really good questions where you can get the most information out of the person rather than just fire off a bunch of minimal questions.
Yeah. So one of the things that I always do is you can't really see it here because of the blur, but I always, when I'm working with a client, I always, and I show this in some of my training videos, I have a sheet of paper that has, it's like divided in certain sections so that I'm writing down everything the client is telling me, whether or not I think it's important doesn't matter. Cause sometimes we don't realize till later that it was really important, you know, that the client always seems to say such and such. I scribble it down. I'm writing it so fast that I don't want it to become ever like the client has to sort of slow down so I can write, you know, I'm just writing my own scribbles, keywords, keeping up. And then to your professor's point, what I'm also doing in the sidebars of that paper, there's a sidebar section. I am writing questions down. And, you know, to your point, the client might even answer my question 2 minutes later if I just don't interrupt them. So that's fine. I don't interrupt them. But I make sure I've got a good list going in the sidebar so that when they do take a breath and look at me and say, wow, what do you think? Again, I'm not just sitting there going, oh, you know, I have a whole list of questions, kind of thought-provoking questions. And it's handy, I think, to be able to have that.
Oh, yeah, that happens to me all the time in my regular life, too, where it's just like, I'll stop. I want to ask a question, but I'll just listen a little bit longer. And that person naturally will just answer my question that I was going to ask them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful thing.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I can imagine too, like when it comes to dating anxiety, they go hand in hand, especially compared to today, let's say like 30 years ago, right? It's changed so much.
Yeah, and definitely. My heart goes out to singles.
Well, what is your thought on that? Is it just more of, okay, let's throw it out there. Internet online dating. That's, I feel like changed a lot of things. I feel like when it comes to accessibility, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's wonderful.
Right. Cause like it, well, it's easier. Well, it's no, easier. Let me scratch that. It may be easier for some people. Like, because I know you're bringing this up in your Ten Commandments. You, as a person, when you're going out dating or whatever, you need to have a number in your head. Do you want to elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, sure. Rule two, numbers for you. Okay. In the Dr. Chloe's Ten Commandments of Dating book, it's number two. And again, I prepped the dating book with a caveat of saying that this book is intended for people that have a clear objective goal that they are specifically dating in order to find a relationship that leads to marriage, right?
Okay.
So my tips and advice are coming from that framework. And that's why rule two numbers for you means that you think about, okay, well, am I 22 years old and my goal is to get married, you know, maybe by the time I'm 30, because I'm thinking about, you know, kids and all that stuff. Okay, well, great. I've got all the time in the world. You know, I do know I need to be out there dating and going on a certain amount of first dates to meet people, but maybe that's one date a month even. Who knows? Whatever. You're 22. You've got a lot of time. If you're 28 and you're like, well, I want to get married by the time I'm 30, then maybe you need to go out on 5 dates a week if you want to make sure that you're really giving yourself a big enough pool of people, you know, from which to choose. And I make it clear again, everyone's dating number is different and you don't have to do this stupid dating, you know, book if you don't want to, but that this is just something that in my experience as a woman myself, as well as a clinical psychologist in New York City, one of the toughest dating markets that there is, that these approaches were productive.
Okay. It's funny because when I do my group sessions, I'll do pros and cons exercise with my clients. And it's more of, if you do decide to go with this action, what are the pros and cons? And if you don't decide to do it, what are the pros and cons? And one of the topics I give is dating multiple people. So my clients would think of pros and cons to each action. And to the one where a con for dating multiple people, let's say within a month, is you're going to have less time with each person, and it's going to make it more difficult to find more in-depth conversation with that one person when you're dating, let's say hypothetically, four or five other women. Now, there's a lot of different ways I guess we can go about that, because let's say after the first date, you don't need to have like a second date with someone. So I guess it would naturally go down from there. But what are your thoughts on that?
What you're saying is true, and a certain level that if you spend less time with someone, you don't have as much intimacy and get to know them as well. On one level, I can see what you're saying. On the other hand, we also do get to know someone through longevity of time and frequency of time that we see the person, right? So I might actually know you in some ways better by seeing you twice, I'm sorry, three times for 2 hours each, than by spending one night with you from 6 p.m. till midnight, right? Because if I let some time pass between the time, I actually have the advantage of getting to see you at different times of day, and in different points in your life and in your week. For example, if I'm interviewing someone for a job, it's common knowledge for employers that you interview the person in the evening, you interview them in the morning, and you interview them in the afternoon, because anybody can just show up and make a good impression once. But maybe I want to know, do they know how to be on time every time? Did I just get them in a good mood today? How dedicated are they really to this, right? So for if I end a date with someone and it's been a really great date, it's not unusual, for me as well as, for many. I'm married. I've been married 10 years now, so I'm not in this, but many people say that they went on this amazing date and then they never heard from the person again. Because part of what you're also learning on dates 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is what are the person's follow-up skills like? Do they think about you when you're not around? You don't really get to know that about them unless you have some time between. So I think there is something to be said for getting to know somebody a little slower rather than some kind of a flash intimacy experience.
Yeah, because again, you never know how the other person's feeling about you, where you just had like you felt like you had a great and amazing time, but they might have had a, it was okay.
Yeah. And then there's also the fact that the more time we spend with someone, the more emotionally invested we become in them. And so, again, I think there's something to be said for holding back on that emotional investment until, you get to see, well, does the person follow up and ask you for more dates or accept your request for more dates as time goes on? You get to know someone sometimes a little slower can be better.
And I don't know if you've ever experienced this with your clients, but a theme of anxiety could be to what is your intent? Because many individuals may not be true to their content or what they want to do in the relationship right off the bat.
Right, which again is to me why slower is better, right? Because if somebody says, like, well, I'm just, looking for somebody that's here for a serious relationship, not a bunch of physical stuff. I'm not trying to just, have a fling. I want a real re relationship with somebody I can rely on. Okay, well, if they say that, but then by, date three, they're demanding sex, that tells you a lot, right? So, I think we learn a lot by watching someone's behavior, which sometimes requires time.
Or even texting, even like texting prior to the first date, you'll learn a lot about someone's behavior.
Yeah, responsiveness or, thoughtfulness. Although prior to the first date, I do give people a bit of a pass because I think a
Really?
lot of people, they do, yeah, because they don't want to have like a big texting relationship with somebody. They're like, okay, like we can text to like arrange the date, but no, I'm not going to get to know you over text. Like I'll save that in person.
But okay, maybe I'm misleading or misunderstanding, but like, let's say if somebody says something so off the wall through text, There's got to be like red flags where you just be like, no, we're not going to do the date. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep. 100% I agree with you there. I just thought you meant like for people that are not big texters, I give someone a pass for that.
No, but honestly, though, you make a really good point because I've had that issue too in dating where we just talked way too much prior to even meeting. So then again, what are you going to talk about the first or second date when you know all this like dialogue about the person already?
Well, also the dialogue is not just for the exchange of information, right? Which is really all that's happening over text. It's just kind of a sterile exchange of information. Whereas a lot that's actually important is the context around the way that that information is shared and conveyed. It's just a richer experience to do that in person.
But also too, honesty is so important. And again, I hate doing the male and female examples, but again, I mean, no disrespect, no sexism, no nothing. But let's say hypothetically, like the man just tells the woman like, hey, I'm just dating, whatever, like fooling around, whatever. The woman needs to understand that. And at times through when I've, you know, worked with people, the woman or the other partner or person will still continue that relationship, even though they know they just want sex and that person wants a relationship. They may continue with that. They may even have sexual intercourse in hopes of possibly getting into a serious relationship.
Which is foolish.
But it happens. We're all human, right?
Yes, but it's to our own benefit to realize and recognize when we're doing something foolish. And right. I mean, I think it's foolish to give yourself sexually and emotionally to someone who has flat out told you that they don't want it. I mean, that's just masochistic or foolish or maladaptive, whatever word we want to use. It's not even self-serving. So if I had a client that was telling me, yeah, I'm unhappy and I'm giving it to somebody who's telling me that they just, you know, are only looking for good times. And here I am feeling so empty. You can bet what I'd be talking about with that person.
Right. Absolutely. And also, but I think our society also plays a huge impact on that too, about like norms for men and women. As it comes to that, where I forgot the point I was trying to make. No, it goes into a lot of different factors. Now, again, a lot of the society will say, no, well, the guy's the bad one no matter what. It's like, no, he was honest. It would be bad in a sense, and this happens a lot too. This happens a lot where the man will lie or the other individual will lie and verbally tell the person what they want to hear. Yeah, I could be open to a serious relationship or this and that, whatever. So again, that gets that person in.
See, that's not good enough. And
it works.
Well, yeah, sure. Works. Great. You know, I mean, it also, on a certain level, I mean, you could say it works to go rob 7-Elevens, you know, but that doesn't mean it's a sustainable, you know, way to live your life. So
it's mean. Yeah, I mean, it's just mean too. It's yeah.
But again, it's also incumbent, I think, on I would never say it's always the guy's fault. Absolutely not. Honestly, I think that's insulting to the woman to say that she doesn't have enough wisdom and discernment herself to be able to have that, you know, personal responsibility to say, wait a minute, he may have told me X, but he's doing Y and I need to change. But just to zero in, I need to change, meaning I need to stop seeing this person. But to zero in also on what you said about like a guy who says like, oh, well, I could be open to a relationship. And then it kind of seems like he's not. When I say that's not good enough, and I go into this very explicitly in my book, you don't want to, if your goal is to get married, especially if it's to get married and have kids, but if your goal is to get married, you do not want to be with somebody who says, well, I'm open to a serious relationship. You want to be with somebody who says, I want a serious relationship. Reason being, serious relationships take work. They take effort. Yeah. You have to stick with it even when things are rough. Otherwise, why would you do the work, right? If your position is, I'm open to a serious relationship, I'm also open to flings, I'm going to go with whatever works for me. Why would that person go through the hard work of a lasting relationship when they would be just as content to swipe left and, you know, whatever. Yep. So I think you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't read my book and, you know, and do what it says, which it would be to not be open to somebody who says, I'm potentially open to a serious relationship. If you know that what you are really seriously wanting for sure is a serious relationship. Otherwise you're in a one down position and you're putting yourself there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so cool. Cause we were talking about this topic, one of my grad school classes, and this woman actually gave an amazing example where when she starts a relationship, she chooses not to have sex right away, because if she does, she feels like that's what the relationship is based on, sex.
100%. Yeah. I mean, and I don't even blame men for that. You know, I mean, their biology, right? It's just, it's set up in a certain way.
I'm glad you say that, because I know a lot of women will disagree with you on that. Just like the hormones, right? You're talking about the hormones, right? And like our biology and how we're made up.
Yeah, absolutely. And
thank you so much for saying that. Thank you so much too for saying that. I appreciate that. I really do.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it's like controversial.
It's very, well, maybe I'm just misunderstanding, but it's like, yes, our biology is different. We're programmed differently, but a lot of people say, well, that's no excuse. That's no, you should still be a decent human being.
But see, there's nothing indecent about choosing to sleep around, right? I'm actually coming at this from a totally non-prudish standpoint. Mm-hmm. I say there's nothing indecent about it, whether you're a man or a woman. If you say my interest is in having lots of great casual sex whenever the hell I feel like it, that's fine. To me, the issue is if you want a long lasting, serious relationship and, you know, you're dating a man, you know, just know that he can't even help it. But the intensity and the focus of his interest is going to change when we introduce sex into the picture. And if you want like a true read of how he is without, you know, like the kind of heaviness and intensity of sex, of new sex, you know, being in the air, then you can't put new sex in the air.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about like how they may be acting a certain way or behaving a certain way, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but then after they have sex, what their behavior after that is very important?
I'm saying that when a man is having sex with somebody new, there's a high level of excitement and infatuation that he'll have. And yes, it's true for women too, to a certain degree, but it's different for men, right? So if, for example, you have sex with a man on Friday and he texts you on Saturday to say, I'm dying to see you again. Can I see you again?
Yeah.
For all you know, whether he's even being honest with himself about it, who knows? What he's really on some level potentially saying is, I'm dying to hit that again. Whereas like if you just have dinner and you make it very clear that, you know, you're not having sex outside of a committed relationship and you're not even going to be having a committed relationship unless he's able to articulate a vision for why you should be in a committed relationship, meaning I see this heading towards engagement and marriage, like within, you know, a year or two or whatever. If that is too daunting of a conversation for him to have, then it's probably not the right time to be having sex. If you know that when you have sex, the feelings get big and real for you, then why would you do that to yourself?
So when you have that conversation, are you actually using those words, let's say after the fifth date or whatever, and you're talking about being in a more committed relationship? Is that what you're talking about? Is like, I see us, you know, possibly getting married in a year, year and a half, if this goes well?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's, if a man's not able to discuss that, then that's okay. Yeah. But I would take that as a sign that if he's not even ready to discuss a personal hypothetical plan that he wants, you know, then I would just say he's probably not that serious about this goal of finding somebody to be with, which is okay. Mm-hmm. Again, like, I don't think every relationship has to be marriage oriented. People don't tend to get their feelings hurt quite as much then in those situations. If you're like, I just want to be out there and find myself and have some good sex and meet guys and whatever, that's totally fine. But if your goal is to get married and you find yourself constantly holding the bag, the emotion bag, feeling left and lonely and abandoned and misunderstood and everything else, then maybe try something different, which would be showing a little bit more discretion before you make yourself sexually vulnerable.
Yeah. And again, you could have the conversation of, yeah, I want to get married. I want to eventually, if things work out, and that could be true, loving and honest, but then like 3 months, 4 months down the road, it doesn't work out. And again, there's no harm, no foul. It just didn't work out.
Yeah, totally true. But I just think that you have a better chance of discovering that. Like if it just didn't work out, right? There's usually a reason.
A man can still lie
that.
though. I'm cynical, but like a man can still lie. Oh yeah, I could see us getting into a marriage in a year and a half. But again, he could have no intention of that, but still continue this basic relationship.
Totally
for months.
True.
But she needs to pick up on those red flag signals, right?
Right. Which is, I mean, again, there's no foolproof system. But I mean, again, that would be why I think I say as well in my book that you would want to know somebody for at least a month before you would consider, you know, getting into that with them, right? Because we've all even just known people that, like, I've done it myself. Like, I'm out having drinks with friends and they're like, yeah, we're going to go see this movie tomorrow. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds awesome. I'm going to go. And like, I mean it in the moment. And then the next day comes, and I'm like, oh, I totally don't want to go see that movie. Yep. I don't even feel like seeing those people again for a little while. Like I was just caught up in the moment.
Yep.
And that's fine. We all get caught up in the moment. But the way to make sure you don't become the casualty of getting somebody else is caught up in their moment is to just not go deep into sex and see if they do indeed call you and keep dating you and keep seeing you and keep building mm-hmm. something with you for a month or two before you go and have sex, because that's how you'll probably discover certain things about incompatibility. It's better to discover them before you get super deep.
Yep, that's so true. And also, this is such an awkward. I remember like in another one of your videos, you're talking about like, obviously like the numbers game and everything. And have you ever heard of the term, like, it's like a particular dating, but you're dating multiple people, right? And you go to the person in your first date or whatever, and this conversation comes up. It's like, do you want to openly date or do you just want to date me right now?
Exclusivity?
Yes, yes, yes. And it's just so funny because do you know Bill Burr?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I do a reaction video towards him and I think he gives pretty damn good advice for a comedian. So he talks about the scenario where this person wrote in through email and this individual is like, you know, having a friends with benefit relationship with his roommate. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about like down the road, you got to get ready when you start dating other people. So then the conversation came up like on just an example of a date where the woman's asking him, hey, are you dating anyone else? Are you exclusive? This or that. And then the guy would say, oh, yeah, I have a kind of have a friends with benefit thing going on right now, but it's nothing serious. And then the woman getting upset, he's like, well, yeah, of course, if I have feelings for you, I would stop that. But I'm not going to take it off the table for one trip at Applebee's.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking in my head, like, that would never, I don't know, that there's probably a 5% chance that conversation would probably ever happen in real life. In my head, I could be wrong.
Well, that's in part, though, because the woman is initiating that conversation, which is something I generally advise women not to do. Again, just because men are typically the ones who are going to be pressing for sex. Right. So I suggest that she waits until he's pressing for sex and then just say, you know, that she's not ready yet and leave it up to him to make the case to say, well, what do you mean? Why are you not ready? What would make you feel ready? Yeah. And then she'd be like, well, for one thing, you know, we haven't even, you know, discussed anything to do with exclusivity or a future or anything. And I'm not even saying I'm ready for that conversation, but that would be like a step one, right? Up to him, you know, to bring it up.
Well, that does it for part one of Dating, Relationships, and Anxiety with special guest, Dr. Chloe Carmichael. She did an awesome and amazing job, and I cannot wait to work with her in the future. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called CalmEgo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.